So Father, once again, we come to you and we are asking that through your Spirit you work in us today as we come to hear from your word. The word that you spoke, the word that you ordained for us to have, that you sovereignly directed to be written down by men, to be protected and canonized and to be given to us today. We are so thankful that we have probably on our shelves at home many copies of your word that we can go to. I pray that we don't take that for granted, and I certainly pray that we don't take for granted what is taking place this morning as we open up your word to hear from you. And so I pray that you would speak, that we would have ears and hearts to listen and to receive, and that the Spirit of God would use these words to work in us and to change us into the image of Christ. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated this morning as we come together as a fellowship of believers to the Lord's table and remember what He has done for us through His sacrifice. Let me invite you to turn to Isaiah chapter 52. Isaiah chapter 52. Now, Isaiah was sent by God to Israel to warn them of coming judgment because of their sin. However, in the midst of his words of judgment, there is hope, because Isaiah points to a deliverer, a servant who would come. He points to a Messiah who would deliver his people. And it is in these verses that we see him foretelling the sacrifice of Christ for our sins. Please follow along as I begin reading in Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13. Isaiah 52, beginning in verse 13. "Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up, and shall be exalted, as many were astonished at you. His appearance was so marred, beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him, for that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned, everyone, to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he has seen, and he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. As we read down through these verses, we see that Isaiah is showing us that the Messiah, who is to come, will come as a sacrifice for the sins of man. Not as a deliverer from Rome, as the Jews came to think this to mean, but this servant that Isaiah is talking about would be a suffering servant. And he describes even the great suffering that he would endure. In the final verses of chapter 52, we see that Jesus was so violently mistreated that he was unrecognizable as a man. When they were through with Christ and he was hanging on the cross, his figure was so distorted from the torture that he had endured, it would have been hard to recognize him, not just as, is that Jesus, but is that even a man that is on the cross? So Isaiah gives cause for a reality check for us this morning that not even Hollywood has accurately portrayed, and probably rightly so, for we could not bear it. The picture the Bible paints of Jesus' death is one that is hard for us to accept. But when you consider what he went through, you have a clear understanding of what Isaiah is saying and the extent of the suffering that Jesus endured. It is why Jesus was in such anguish when he was in the garden. Jesus knew his arrest would be the beginning of great suffering and ultimately death. The temple guards who came for him, they seized him and they drug him into a false trial where the Pharisees declared him guilty even though they had absolutely no grounds to do so. In Mark chapter 14, verse 64, at the end of Jesus' trial, his accusers say this, "You have heard his blasphemy, what is your decision?" And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying, "Prophesy." And the guards received him with blows. In other words, when they handed them over to the temple guards, the beating just continued. Then they delivered Jesus over to the Romans. Now, we know this. Obviously, the Romans were not known for their hospitality, but they were known for their brutality. Jesus was taken before Pilate, who sent him to Herod, who sent him back to Pilate. And while Jesus would have been exposed to the cruelty of the Roman guard throughout these transitions, there would have been no politeness or concern for well-being, only constant aggression from men looking to excuse to demonstrate mercilessness and inflict shame. That's what they did. That's what they enjoyed doing. So having been beaten and mocked, drugged from one false trial to another, without food or water, Jesus was taken before the Jews who demanded from Pilate that he be crucified. And after much internal debate, Pilate gives in, and Jesus is taken, and he is flogged, and he is crucified. Now the Romans had perfected flogging as a form of torture. Those that administered it were well trained. They were able to take a victim right to the point of death without going over. The whip they used, called the cat of nine tails, was actually several strands of leather that had iron balls and pieces of bone and other sharp objects intermittently tied down into each strand. And Jesus would have been stripped of his clothing, tied to a post. And then one or maybe even two soldiers standing on either side would have begun to viciously whip him. The iron balls would have slammed against Christ's body, causing great pain and deep contusions, while the bone would have dug deep into his flesh. And then as the soldiers pulled back on the whip, the results would not only have been extremely painful, but extremely destructive and damaging to his body. The soldiers would have systematically worked their way down from Jesus' shoulders down to his feet on both sides of his body until all the lashes had been administered. After this torturous ordeal, it was common practice for the soldiers then to mock their victims. And in Matthew 27, verse 27, we read, "Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him, and they took the reed, and they struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe, and they put his own clothes on him, and they led him away to crucify him. And then as Jesus was led to the actual place of his crucifixion, he would have been carrying his own execution device on his back. But by the time they actually drove the nails in his hands and his feet, fastening him to the cross and dropping it into that hole where it would stand, Christ would have already endured the most horrific mental and physical trial imaginable. And when we envision what Jesus went through, we often want to turn away, to hide our faces and to not think about his death in these real and vivid details. However, Jesus doesn't desire for his disciples to remember the Hollywood version of these events. When he said at the Last Supper, "In remembrance of me," he didn't intend for them just to remember the happy times. Remember the context of those words. Jesus is eating bread and drinking wine that represented his body and his blood that he is about to shed for them. So he says to them, "Do this in remembrance of me," because he knows exactly what is to come. He knows the sacrifice and the suffering that he is going to endure. And so he says, "When you do this, remember not just me, but remember the suffering and the sacrifice that I went through." He intends for us to remember his suffering and all of its ugliness and its brutality. And it's important that we not minimize the extent to which Jesus endured or downplay the brutality and the injustice he experienced. We should not gloss over the physical pain or bodily mutilation that occurred. And the reason is because it reveals in vivid details some things that we need to remember about the gospel. First, the suffering of Jesus reveals the measure of God's holiness. It reveals the measure of God's holiness. Isaiah speaks of this servant that we know to be Christ. In verse 3 through 5 of chapter 53, he makes a contrast between who Jesus would be perceived to be and who he actually was. From the outside, he was thought to be someone of no real consequence. Jesus was despised and he was rejected by men. He had no form that would be attracting to men. They didn't esteem him because, as it says in verse 4, they considered him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. In other words, people thought Jesus was being punished by God, and so they rejected him as God's Messiah. Certainly, God would not allow this to happen to his one who was sending to deliver us. However, verse 9 tells us he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. So Christ was not afflicted because of any wrongdoing on his part. It was not Christ's sin that brought on the scourging and the shame and the ridicule. It certainly was not some series of unfortunate events that sent Jesus to the cross. And so then why did Jesus suffer? Why did he die? Well, verse 5 tells us, "He was pierced for our transgressions and he was crushed for our iniquities." That's verse 5 of 53. Jesus didn't die on the cross for his guilt. He died on the cross for our guilt. Your sin and my sin is why Jesus was crucified. In verse 6 of chapter 53, it tells us, "All men like sheep have strayed away." In other words, we all, in rebellion towards the great shepherd, have decided that our way is best and have taken the path that we think best. Think about that. He is comparing us to a sheep. Here are sheep. They don't know what's going on. They know that they're supposed to eat and they're supposed to drink. And so the shepherd, his job is to protect them. He's to guide them where they are to go for what is best for them. He's to guide them away from things that are going to harm them. And so here's the shepherd, and he is saying, "Go this way and do not go that way." And we, like sheep, have said to the shepherd, "I don't care for your instructions. I know better. I'm going to do my own thing." We have all gone our own way. That's why it says in verse 6 that God laid on Jesus the iniquity of us all. The reason Jesus was treated with such brutality was because he was paying the price for your sin and for my sin. Jesus received the wrath we deserved because we sinned against a holy God. And if you think that is unfair or if you think that is cruel, then you do not understand the holiness of God. See, the magnitude or the depth of our sin is not measured by how it relates to the sin of others. But that's what we do. Why would God pour out His wrath on me? I mean, I'm not in jail. I haven't committed murder. That's not fair. They're the ones that deserve God's wrath. But the magnitude of our sin is measured by how it relates to the holiness of the Creator God that we turned our back on and we rejected. See, if you want to know the extent of your sin, do not measure it with your neighbor. Do not measure how deep your sin is based on how bad their sin is. Measure your sin based on the holiness of God. And when you compare your sin to God's holiness, you see the depth of your sin. His holiness defines the necessary response to our sin. See, because God is righteous, He cannot wink at our sin. He cannot just give a speech about why our actions are wrong, send us to the corner for a timeout so we can think about what we've done. Our sin is deserving of the full righteous hatred of a perfect and holy God. So in bearing the guilt of our sin, Christ also had to bear the wrath that our sin deserved. The suffering of Christ reminds us that God is holy and that we deserve the wrath of a holy God because we have rejected Him. That is what hell is. That is what our sin deserves. That is what Christ experienced in His death. Jesus suffered so greatly because your sin is so great. And our sin is so great because our God is so holy. So as you take the bread and the juice this morning, it should remind you that Christ bore the full wrath of a holy God, not because He was guilty, but because you were guilty. He was beaten and He was bruised because of your rebellion. He shed His blood, not because you messed up or made a mistake, but because you turned your back on the love of a holy God. This is why Paul warns us not to approach this table together casually, thinking that unconfessed sin is no big deal. In 1 Corinthians 11:26, Paul says, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes. Whoever confesses, or whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the blood, the body and blood of the Lord. So let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself." If you approach the Lord's table clinging to your sin, dragging it along, unwilling to let it go, then Paul says that's a pretty good indicator you are not saved and you are under the judgment of God. You cannot come and participate. You cannot come to the very ordinance which was instituted to remind us of God's holiness and the price paid because of our sin, and declaring that that sacrifice of Jesus is sufficient for the forgiveness of your sin and still harbor sin in your heart. You cannot participate in the remembrance of His sacrifice and have no problem clinging to the sin that you hold to as you do it. That makes a mockery of the holiness of God. It makes a mockery of what Christ accomplished through His suffering. Christ's suffering does not allow you to minimize your sin. It does not allow you to blame it on something or someone else. His suffering does not allow you to point the finger at other people's sin because it makes you feel better about your own sin. The fact is, the holiness of God means that my sin and your sin necessitated the crucifixion of Jesus. Maybe the reason you need to rest your eyes upon the ugliness of the cross this morning is so that deep conviction will confront you and confront your sin, that sin that you continue to harbor in your life and that you will not let go of. God is reminding you once again through these elements that He is holy and that Christ suffered to make the unholy holy. But second, the suffering of Jesus reveals the magnificence of God's love. The magnificence of God's love. I want you to drop down to verse 10 of chapter 53 and look with me there again. "Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush Him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offering. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowing, by his knowledge, shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. Isaiah says that this servant will make many to be accounted righteous. And at the end of verse 12, he says he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for their transgressions. The depth of our sin required the wrath of God, but God's great love redirected his wrath to Christ so that we could be forgiven and saved from that wrath. In verse 10, Isaiah speaks of life for this servant after he is crushed by God. Again, in verse 12, it is after death that he will receive a portion of the spoils. Spoils only go to those who survive a victorious battle. And so Isaiah is pointing not only to Christ's death, he's pointing to his resurrection. That there is going to be life even after he is crushed. Jesus' resurrection is the key to his intercession, which is the key to our eternal salvation. He could not intercede for us if he was still in the grave. Jesus' victory over sin and death means we can have God's forgiveness, an eternal forgiveness guaranteed by Christ's continued intercession before God on our behalf. Romans 8, 33 and 34. Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died, more than that, who was raised, who is present right now at the right hand of God, who indeed is right now present interceding for us. It is a continual act of intercession that Christ works for us. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 25. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Always lives to constantly make intercession on our behalf. What should blow your mind about the cross is that in the very same act of crucifixion, God showed both his righteous indignation toward sin and his magnificent love toward the sinner. Though you transgressed God's law, Jesus was treated as a criminal in your place. Though the judgment of God was due your sin, Christ was declared guilty on your behalf. And so as God crushed his son, he was at the same moment providing salvation for you and me. As God's wrath rained down on Christ, his love poured out on us. A love that will never fade because Christ is alive and forever intercedes for us. Christ's death says your sin and God's holiness does not mix. And so God poured his wrath out on Christ because he bore your sin. And in that act, in that moment, God was also declaring his great love for you, because that was the means by which his grace and his mercy could be given to you. Listen, maybe the reason you need to rest your eyes on the ugliness of the cross this morning is so that you will be reminded of the unfathomable love of God toward you. As you come to the Lord's table today, look at the brutality of the cross and tremble in fear before the righteous justice and wrath of a holy God. And yet at the very same time, be overwhelmed by a loving God who sacrificed his son so you could have a relationship with him. A love that invites you to come boldly into the throne room of God and receive the grace that you need today and tomorrow and the next day. And when you sin, and when you fall, and when you doubt, he is always there at the right hand of God, interceding on your behalf, inviting you in to the grace of God. Unbelievable. Listen, I pray this morning that as we come to the Lord's table, as we approach these elements that remind us of what Christ has done, that you will not take lightly the suffering of Christ. I pray that His sacrifice in all of its ugliness, His suffering in all of its bloody gore, will arrest your heart to all the beauty of His glory. And I pray you will be drawn closer to Christ and deeper into the arms of God. Let's prepare this morning to participate together in the taking of these elements. Have our deacons come forward and prepare.